I'm Patrick Scahill for WNPR News. It's one of the most ordinary things you can think of, charcoal. Today you can buy the black briquettes at your local supermarket, but charcoal's story wasn't always confined to American grills and backyards. For a long time, the brick was the lifeblood of Connecticut's iron industry, fueling furnaces that created everything from weapons of war to iron wheels that rolled across the country. Now you can find that history all over Connecticut's woods. The relics might be scattered everywhere, but that doesn't mean finding them is always easy.
Unfortunately, it's very subtle, and as you can tell, since I'm having a little harder time remembering where this is.
Emery Gluck and I are stumbling through Whitney Forest in Lebanon. Gluck is a volunteer here, helping manage the space with the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association.
I think we got to go this way, sorry.
We're looking for charcoal. Basically, it's old wood that got burned in a controlled fire and transformed into a purer form of carbon that can be used as fuel. Up until the early 20th century, people called colliers made the stuff, and the work wasn't glamorous.
They lived in hovels, in the woods.
Today, if you're lucky, you can find relics of those hovels, old stone chimneys, Icelanded in the middle of the forest. But as Gluck and I stumble off trail, we need a keener eye. There aren't any old chimneys here, just less obvious signs of charcoal mounds, little undulations in the land about 30 feet in diameter that are covered with soil that's black, not brown. Eventually, we stumble into one.
Here's some charcoal.
Oh, look at that.
I didn't plant that, I promise you.
Okay.
Holding the small shards of black charcoal, you can't help but imagine what it was like to manage a charcoal pit in the 18th and 19th century. Back then, Connecticut's forests would have looked a lot different. Hills were stripped of trees and wood piled to make charcoal. To learn how colliers did this, I met up with Lance Hansen. He's with the Wildlife Division at the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and outside of work, he's a bit of a charcoal obsessive. As we hike over at Goodwin State Forest in Hampton, I can see why.
There's a point where you'd be like, because it's right there on the center of the view. So that's intentional to get people to come check out this architectural folly out in the woods.
Out here in the forest, Hansen's actually built a replica charcoal mound. Wood is piled several feet high, a smaller scale model of what colliers would have done centuries ago to make fuel. There's a chimney in the center.
And you try to make it as tight as possible because this is where you don't want air coming in. And then you fill the inside of it all with logs, smaller logs, that when you eventually are going to dump in the embers to light it, that's what we'll catch.
Colliers tended to the embers with a big stick called a Fagan pole.
So the collier could lift it out. They can see from the charring how it's going. As the pile shifts, as it starts to burn, that it helps them find the center.
To do this, the collier would actually climb on top of the mound and sometimes have to jump the pit, leaping over what was essentially a smoldering hellmouth. One 1901 newspaper account describes a 16-year-old collier in West Cornwall who fell 20 feet into one mound, his clothing ablaze as he climbed out of the pit, walked home, and eventually died. But colliers seemed to think the risks were worth it. After all, Hansen says the nearby market for charcoal was huge.
You think metal in that time, you'd think Pennsylvania, Ohio would have been the place. No, it was Connecticut. It was the northwest corner of Connecticut, Berkshires and Massachusetts, and then eastern New York.
A place called the Salisbury Iron District, which hosted dozens of iron furnaces from the time ore was discovered there in 1731. By a waterfall on the Blackberry River in East Canaan, notched into a side hill, I look at one of the places where, starting in 1847, charcoal from all over Connecticut and later the nation would be burned, the Beckley Iron Furnace. Dick Paddock, a volunteer at the massive restored marble structure, says for nearly 200 years, iron ore from the Salisbury district turned up everywhere. Charcoal burned in the region's furnaces created cannons used during the American Revolution. Later on, Paddock says local iron was a hit in one other particular market, too.
Railroad freight car wheels, 33-inch freight car wheels.
Yeah.
For a reason we don't yet fully understand, iron from this portion of Connecticut was exceptionally strong and resistant to cracking, and the contemporary information we have from the period they manufactured them says that they usually would outlast the cars they were under.
But Paddock says the iron industry here had another lasting legacy, open space. Here's what happened. Beckley and other furnaces consumed so much charcoal that acres and acres of land were bought up, trees taken down, burned, and made into charcoal. After a while, it was hard to keep up.
Toward the end of operation here, charcoal and or wood for charcoal was coming from Vermont and as far away as Michigan. So we had consumed our forests.
But trees on that charcoal land kept growing, even after Beckley closed in 1919.
And therefore, that land never developed because it was being used as a resource. And that's where we get things like People's State Forest, Great Mountain Forest, Housatonic Meadows. That's all old iron land, iron company land that was being used as charcoal source.
That today is open space for us to enjoy. Regrown forests pockmarked with shards of hidden charcoal that, if you know where to look, are subtle windows into our state's industrial past. Patrick Scahill, WNPR News.